How many people are on?
Good evening, and welcome to Congressman Tom Suozzi's Teletown Hall that will focus on the coronavirus outbreak. In a moment, you will hear from Congressman Suozzi, who will be joined by health expert Michael Dowling, President and CEO of Northwell Health, and Dr. Maria Carney, who is the former commissioner of the Nassau County Department of Health and is currently Chief Geriatric and Palliative Medicine Chief at Northwell Health. This call will be an opportunity for you to get an update from these experts and ask questions about the coronavirus. Everyone on the call will be placed on mute. If you would like to ask a question, please press zero. After you leave your message, it will enter the queue and you will be placed back on the call. We will attempt to get to as many questions as possible. Thank you for your participation tonight. I will now turn the program over to Congressman Suozzi.
Well, good evening, everyone, and thank you so much for joining me. I want to thank especially Mike Dowling, the President and CEO of Northwell Health. Northwell is the largest healthcare provider and private employer in New York State, and before serving this position for so many years, he was the State Director of Health, Education, and Human Services, Deputy Secretary to the Governor. He was also the Commissioner of the New York State Department of Social Services. And I also want to thank Maria Carney, who served as the Nassau County Health Commissioner when I was the County Executive, and she is now the Director of Geriatrics at Northwell. So thank you both for being on the call with us tonight. So this is a very tough time for all of us, and I want to thank everybody for joining us on the call. Locally, we've seen the number of cases of coronavirus grow in New York and around the country. And during this time, I want to keep on emphasizing over and over again, we need to be prepared, not scared. Be prepared, not scared. That's one of the reasons for this call, trying to get as many facts out there as possible so we can act urgently, and we can act responsibly. I'm going to talk for a few minutes, then I'm going to turn it over to Mike Dowling, then Maria Carney, and then we're going to open it up for questions. But let me just speak for about 5 minutes or so. Let me first say that this is a very complex issue. When we're dealing with it, we have to look at it in a comprehensive way. And there are two major categories of what we need to look at. Number one, and most urgently, is the healthcare issues. Two is the effects on the economy and on people individually as well as their businesses. So we're going to focus for the first half of the call tonight mainly on healthcare issues. When I think about the healthcare issues, I think about it in four different categories. One is prevention. That's probably the biggest thing. Two is testing. Three is treatment. And four is vaccines. When I think about the economic issues, I think about individuals, I think about healthcare workers. I think about small businesses. I think about government. I think about big business. And then I think about the long-term economic impacts. So all of these different things have to be looked at in a comprehensive approach. And that's what's happening with our healthcare professionals, with our government officials at the state, local, and federal level, what's happening with the private sector, all working in concert to try and overcome this issue. We've been through tough times before. We've got to get through this tough time again by all working together. Now, first, about prevention. Prevention is probably the most important focus for everybody on this call right now. When you hear about social distancing, also it could be called physical distancing, because you can still be social with people, but you've got to do it over the telephone, or you've got to use social media, or you've got to be standing 6 feet apart from other people. But social distancing is the most important thing we need to do right now. You know, I heard some crazy stories yesterday about a guy who went to a bachelor party over the weekend, and they were playing beer pong. I heard about people that wanted to have a wedding. They called the health department. The health department said, you can't have a wedding. They said, okay, we won't have it. They had it anyway, and the police had to go break it up. We hear about kids going out to bars and spring break and things like that. We all need to be much more careful, and we need to practice social distancing where we're trying to find out ways that we can not have contact with other people to spread this disease, because it's very spreadable. And all you'll hear the experts' advice over and over again: wash your hands, don't touch your face, don't go in crowds, don't touch other people. When you're out in public, you have to go shopping or something like that, don't touch the touch screens with your fingers unless you wipe it off first. And let's make sure that our healthcare professionals are protected with masks and gloves, and that's a big challenge right now because we don't have enough of them. Michael, I'm sure, will talk about that in a few minutes. Next is testing. We don't have enough testing. I'm going to ask Michael to talk about that as well. We've seen a dramatic ramp up in testing. The governor talked about Governor Cuomo is doing a fantastic job here. We're all very proud of the governor, how well he's been handling this. We've seen a dramatic increase in testing here in New York State over the past couple days even, and throughout the country over the past couple days. But as a result, we're going to see a much more dramatic reporting of the number of incidents. People are infected already. People are sick already. The more testing we do, the more we're going to uncover that. But we need to keep on increasing the testing to make sure that people who are infected are isolated from other people. Then there's the whole question of treatment, which Michael talked about in detail, related to about the number of hospital beds that we have here, the number of ventilators that we need, the number of healthcare workers that we need, and what type of treatments people can get. You know, if you think about it, if we could figure out the treatment, and the president talked today about some of the treatments that are out there that are being explored, if we could figure out the treatment, this wouldn't be nearly as dramatic an issue. It would be like a flu issue where if it could be treated, people could recover at a much more rapid rate. Right now, we're not certain of the treatment. And last is the long term. Not for 18 months are we going to figure out a vaccine for this. So that's for the long, long term. So I'm not going to talk about the economic issues right now. And I'm going to instead turn it over. But let me just say that at the federal level, at the state level, we're working on plans, and we've already passed some laws to figure out how to put money in people's pockets who are being sent home and are in trouble because they can't just pay their bills. We're trying to figure out how we can protect people with unemployment insurance and food stamps and child care, especially for health care workers, so they feel comfortable going to work. What we can do to get money to governments by increasing their Medicaid payments. We got $6 billion more is going to be sent to the state of New York, spread out through the state mainly, but to the city of New York and to all the counties as well. And then we have to think about small businesses, and we have to think about larger businesses. We have to think about people who can't pay their debts. They can't pay their rent. They can't pay their mortgage. Or they can't pay their credit cards. We have to figure out how to give people some sort of holiday for that. That hasn't been figured out yet, but people are very conscious of it and are working on it together. So before I go any further, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Dowling. He's incredibly busy. We appreciate him taking the time to be with us on the call. I don't know if he can stay for the whole call, but we're very grateful for him right now. And let me just tell you, Michael, that according to my staff, there are now 10,000 people on this call. Michael, why don't you share some thoughts with us?
Thank you, Tom, and thanks for all you do. But and many others, and also for holding an event like this. So let me just make a couple of comments. To follow up on what Tom just said, one of the more important things we all do is the social distancing and the washing of the hands, because if we don't do all of the things that we should be doing, then the problem is only going to get worse and will only continue for a longer period of time. Second point I want to make at the beginning is we will win this. This will be over with at some point. We don't know exactly when, but some people say 2 months, 3 months, etc. But we will eventually be able to look back at this and say, oh boy, we went through a rough time with lots of inconvenience, but we won. So it's important to stay calm. And it's important to keep the fear down, as Tom mentioned, and the anxiety down, because people don't make rational decisions when they're overly anxious and stressed out. So calmness is very, very important. We're in all parts of this as a big, big health system. We do a lot of testing. We have one of the largest labs in the United States. And the testing was slow to begin with, because you need to get all certain kinds of approvals to do the testing. And then you have to have the right procedures, and you got to make sure that the systems work well, because you don't want to test and give the wrong results. So it takes a little bit of time. Today, we are now able to do at Northwell, we are now doing over 1,000 tests a day. We ramped up big time over the last 2 days.
And let me just point out, Michael, let me just point out, the governor said today 7,000 tests statewide. So in addition to Northwell, there are other private
labs. There's the big Wadsworth lab, which is in Albany. That's a major big lab. There are other private labs, commercial labs, that have just, over the last week, have come up to start testing. And all of them are ramping up. So we at our lab will be able to do a couple of thousand tests a day. Now, when you do more tests, you obviously, as Tom said, are going to find more people who are positive. Now, it's important to understand that if there are 100 people tested positive, 80% of them will be able to stay home and basically take care of themselves. 20% of them will probably need to be hospitalized. And only about 5% needs to be incubated. So for the bulk of people that become positive, staying at home, doing all of the right things, which we can talk about, and Marie will talk about, I'm sure, is all that is needed. Many people will have severe symptoms. Others have no symptoms at all. And some people with modest symptoms. We are planning at the moment to, because everybody anticipates that over the next month, the virus will spread, and that there will be a big, more and more people will potentially get sick, which means when you're running a hospital system, you've got to make sure you have the capacity to take care of those sick people. Nobody knows for sure how big the volume will be. Some people have very big projections, some very modest. We don't know for sure. And this is the problem with this virus. There is a lot we don't know, and we're learning as we go along. Well, so what we're doing right now is trying to identify, which we've done, the number of beds that we can make available above and beyond the number of we now have. And one of the things to make that easy, what we've done is we have canceled a lot of surgery. We've canceled a lot of other procedures. Doctors are delaying, seeing patients. So a lot of capacity, new beds, are being made available. We at Northwell can make over 1,000 extra beds available when needed. Now, these can be done, we can do this quickly, and we do it in stages. We don't just open up a big place with 1,000 beds tomorrow. As the volume increases, we increase the number of beds.
So, Mike, let me just point out that also that people have said that the flu season is coming to an end, and that's freeing up some hospital beds as well.
Season is coming to an end, and that's ending up, opening up some beds. And the cancellation of a lot of surgery and a lot of other procedures is opening up a lot of beds. The issues that then you have to worry about, and we're working on, and I want to assure everybody that we will be prepared and we will deal with this successfully. That is something that people should recognize. Healthcare employees are extraordinarily committed. We do this kind of stuff all the time, not as bad as this issue, but we work on very difficult issues all the time. So when you open up all the beds, new beds, extra beds, now you need the staff, and we need supplies. And you all have been reading about the fact that there is a potential problem with supplies. And when I mean supplies, I mean the following. Masks, and there are different kinds of masks for different kinds of events. There are vents, respirators and vents. These are the things that when people talk about ICU beds, intensive care beds, any bed can be made an intensive care bed if you have vents. And Maria may want to go into that a little bit more, because she's a physician. She can explain this better than I.
Sure.
So, and we need gloves and we need gowns. So we are working diligently with everybody else to increase the number of vents we can get, to increase the supply of masks and gloves and gowns. And we're being somewhat successful with that. It's a challenge because a lot of the things that we need have been for years and years produced and manufactured overseas. Most of the masks that we've always used were made in China. Now, of course, during the crisis in China, that whole production process slowed down or stopped. Some of that production process has already re-begun. So the production of masks is beginning to increase. But since everybody's looking for them, this has been a challenge to get the vents, which is the same problem because the supply chain has all changed and manufacturers are not producing vents as fast as we need them, but that production process is increasing as well.
All right,
so
Mike,
we're working
you.
Very, very diligently to increase the number of masks to be completely prepared when that when that volume increases, and we don't know the detail of that volume yet. Tom,
right,
you want to say something?
Yes, thank you very much, Mike. I really appreciate it. I want to try and get some questions, and I want Maria to say a couple things as well. Let me just say a couple things. The federal level, they're working diligently to try and acquire more gloves, to acquire more masks, and to acquire more ventilators. The president has special powers under the Defense Production Act where he can order manufacturers to build this stuff. We want to encourage the president to exercise that power that he has to order the companies to do this if we can't get them to do it voluntarily. The governor is also working to try and acquire these materials as well. We need to have these ventilators, as Michael's pointed out. In the worst-case scenario, this is from the governor, in the worst-case scenario, we're going to need 110,000 beds in New York State. We only have 53,000 beds right now. Everybody's trying to identify where other beds can be. We just got the president to agree to send a ship up that can hold 1,000 beds, not for the people with coronavirus, but to get some of the people out of the existing hospital beds. That'll be up here in a few weeks. In addition, we're going to need ICU beds. We could need as many as 30,000 of them. There's only 3,000 available right now, but there are more ventilators that can be used to convert other places. So it's all hands on deck to try and get this stuff done. With that, I want to ask Maria to speak for a few minutes, and then I want to open it up for questions. People who want to ask questions, please press 0. Right now, there's over 13,000 people on this call. Go ahead, Maria.
Great. Right. Thank you very much, Congressman Swazi, Michael Dowling. It's a real honor to be here with both of you. I've had the opportunity to work with both of you. Congressman Swazi, when you were county executive, I served as commissioner of health in 2009 during H1N1. And now, Michael Dowling, we're working together on this public health emergency. I'm an internist. I'm a geriatrician. I'm involved in care of older adults, and my clinical work is in the outpatient setting, but I'm involved in the care and different models of care serving older adults, whether that be skilled nursing facility, home care, or inpatient teams. So I see the work of our healthcare system across the continuum of care. And with this illness, one of my roles working with the emergency preparedness team is to identify hotspots across the health system to try to send resources early on out to the facilities that may need them to prevent the need for individuals to get hospitalized. And in this experience, I just want to say and call out to the, I'm going to use the word heroism, of our frontline staff, our nurses, our doctors in dealing with this. They are putting themselves at risk, their families at risk. They are dedicated to the care. And I want to thank Michael Dowling for your leadership and creating a sense of calm in the healthcare system. And I really appreciate the opportunity to be here with you, Congressman Swazi, to address this issue. And I think Michael Dowling talked a lot about the illness. I don't need to repeat that, being COVID is largely a mild illness for most people, 80%, as he said. But 20%, and this illness spreads easily, 20% do need hospitalization. So this social isolation or social distancing, physical distancing, is extremely important to protect our health system and its capacity and to protect our healthcare workers. And I appreciate that you're holding this town hall. It's really innovative, and I'm happy to be here.
All right. And let's make sure, everybody, prevention. Don't go out. Don't go to parties. Don't go to bars. Don't go to restaurants. It's sad. It's upsetting for all of us. It's happening in my family as well as everybody else's family. But we have to try and do as much prevention right now as possible. People are like, what can we do? Social distancing is what you can do. Don't get within 6 feet of other people. Don't go to big crowds. Be very careful about that. Okay, so I'd like to open it up for questions. I want you to know that there's a lot of people working on this all over the United States of America, all throughout New York State. There's so many different moving pieces, but working together we can get through with this. So, Cindy, can you start identifying some of the questions we have?
Yes. Our first question will be from Daniel Friedman.
Okay, and where's Daniel from?
Yeah, we don't know.
Okay, Daniel.
Hello. Actually, it's Daniel Friedman's wife.
Okay.
I'm calling from Queens.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Quick question about asymptomatic patients. I am 54 years old. My mother is 85 years old. I am her primary caregiver, but I live with my family, my husband and my two kids. Can I get tested just to make sure that I don't have it since I'm taking care of my elderly mother?
It'll be very difficult for you to get tested. Right now, you know, there's been a limited amount of testing available, and the only people who can get tested are people who, number one, are showing symptoms. Number two, people who have been diagnosed with the coronavirus, and you're in constant contact with those people. And even then, they probably don't want to test you unless you're showing symptoms because you could get a false negative. Or three, if you travel to one of these at-risk countries. So we understand that you want to be tested. A lot of people want to be tested. I'd love to be tested. Many people would love to be tested. But it's not enough availability that everybody can go get tested. I'm actually working.
Will that change?
I'm hoping it will change. I'm working with a private sector company to actually try and get approval through the FDA where they could do quick testing, almost like self-testing with a pinprick. But there's more. Let me just say this. There's testing available now. At all these different facilities for people who are showing symptoms, and they've opened up a drive-through test spot at Jones Beach and at Stony Brook, and I will give you the phone number in a few minutes as to what to call if you're showing symptoms and you want to try to go to one of those drive-through facilities.
Michael, I'm not showing symptoms. Sorry.
I think in terms of acting in your behavior, in washing your hands, if we act like we have the illness and we protect ourselves from others is how we should all be acting. Will the testing become more available? Yes, as Michael Dowling said, it's starting to ramp up, and my hope is that other people will be able to widen up the testing in the community. But it's not quite there yet, but maybe in a few weeks.
And
will
right
it be
now,
free?
Right now, people need to be treating themselves as though they're possibly infected already. That's why this social distancing is so important, because we don't know who's actually infected yet. And certainly healthcare workers have to treat themselves very carefully with masks and gloves wherever possible so that they are protected and they're protecting their patients as well.
Yeah. And watching, especially family members, especially if you have an elderly person in the household, is to wash the hands, as was said, and also clean and, disinfect, tables, chairs, et cetera, and just do, extra cleaning.
And if at all possible, don't go visit your elderly folks. Talk to them on the phone if possible. And if you do go visit them, try and stay 6 feet away from them. Again, I want to just give the phone number to everybody who wants to try and call to try and get an appointment for the state drive-in for Jones Beach or at Stony Brook. You have to call for an appointment first. The number is 888-364-3065. That's 888-364-3065. You have to get an appointment first. Again, you don't have to have symptoms, a fever, a cough, difficulty breathing, or have traveled to a level 2 or 3 country, or if you've been in direct contact with someone who's tested positive for the coronavirus. Okay, with that, let's open it up for the next question. Cindy?
Okay, we have Erwin Eisman from Great Neck.
Okay, Erwin.
Erwin who?
Erwin Eisman?
Yes. It's Judy Eisman on the phone. My husband, first of all, thanks to the three of you that we're really indebted to you. We're Great Neck residents. We're 75 years old. We're okay right now. We don't need to be tested. What is the best way down the line, the safest way to obtain food and medicine when it becomes necessary? We're hearing that there is a place in town where a worker was already, you know, it's a confirmed case. We don't know whether they're shut down or what the protocol is once that happens.
So my, you know, you can't panic, Ms. Eisman, and we appreciate you asking that question because a lot of people are probably feeling the exact same way that you are. And people can go to the supermarket. You can go to get your medicines. You have to be careful when you do it. Try and stay distant from people. If you can wipe things down before you touch the handles or touch the touch screens, that would be helpful to do. But if you have a friend that's younger than you, because if you're 75, we know 75 is the new 55, we know you're a young person, but it's still you're at more risk as a person who's 75 years old. If you have a friend who's younger or a family member that can go shopping for you or you can have something delivered to you, that would be great. This is why our social workers and our not-for-profit workers are so important right now. We're helping people who don't have access to help like that. So you just have to be careful. Let me ask Maria if she has anything to add to that.
Sure. I would try to take advantage of delivery options and have them leave it at your front door. I'm hearing stores are opening up certain times, staggered visiting so that the numbers in stores are less. So, or going to stores at the less busy times, a grocery store early in the morning. But I think there are innovative ideas of how to stagger visits, opening up at certain times and limiting the visits for certain age groups is something we can consider developing through the county or the region or to help limit crowding.
So, again, I want to emphasize, be prepared, not scared. You have to take these steps to try and prevent this from happening. This is, you know, like you worry about catching the flu from somebody else. You have to be careful about that. But this is more transmissible than the flu is. That's why people are so concerned about it. And we don't have the treatment in place yet that we know exactly what we'll do to help people who get this. This is why we need to be very careful right now. The next 2 weeks are very, very important as far as prevention and trying to slow the spread of the coronavirus. Okay, let's open it up for another question. Now, I think Mike put it.
We're now going to hear from Paula Johnson.
Okay, Paula Johnson. Where are you from, Paula?
Paula Johnson. Yes, I'm from East Norwich.
Okay, Paula, go ahead. What's your question?
Yeah. Okay, thanks. Couple things. First of all, as far as the symptoms go, does one have to have a fever? Is that what concludes that you do have the coronavirus? Because so many of these symptoms are kind of like a cold, you know, a sore throat, a cough, that kind of a thing. But do you have to have a fever in order for it to be coronavirus?
I'll let Maria take that one. Yeah,
so there's a lot of questions being asked, the difference between the coronavirus illness, flu, and cold. And coronavirus is distinguished largely by the fever. Fever, muscle aches, fatigue. You can have a sore throat as opposed to, we don't see the nasal congestion of a common cold. The fever, and then getting into a cough and shortness of breath. Those are the main symptoms.
Let me just say, you know, I was with some people the other day. They're very worried because they have allergies, so their nose was running. And, you know, you say, oh, is that my nose running because I have allergies, and I always have allergies because it's springtime now, or is it because I've got the coronavirus? So, of course, there's a lot of anxiety. That's why it's important to know, as Dr. Carney pointed out, a fever is a very big factor in this. A cough also, Maria, is that correct?
Yeah, a cough, shortness of breath, and sometimes a sore throat.
And overall fatigue, you know.
Yes.
But the shortness of breath and the fever are the two big things, I believe.
Okay, we now have 16,000 people on the call. Let's open it up for another question.
We'll now hear from Brian Vogel.
Where's Brian from?
Oh, East Northport.
Okay, Brian, go ahead.
Hi, I'm a primary care physician, and I've been seeing patients in the office coming in with various symptoms. Some of them are very typical of coronavirus, some not so much. You know, obviously we got to be a little bit selective on who we test. but this is, you know, it's escalating rapidly, and at some point the demand for testing is going to outstrip our ability to test. I just want to know, is there some point in which the do we have to test everyone who's symptomatic? I mean, is there going to be a time when someone calls up, they say, oh, I have a fever and a cough, can you just say, and if they're otherwise not in distress, can you say, well, we just assume you have coronavirus and just isolate yourself in place, and or at some point it's going to be the number of people who need testing and have symptoms is going to be beyond our ability to do so.
This is Maria, Dr. Carney. You're bringing up a really good point. The disease is essentially community spread. It's community-wide right now, and the testing initially was initiated to try to identify and to minimize spread, and we're having trouble keeping up with that, as you've heard in the media reports and so forth. So testing is still important to try to identify outbreaks, minimize spread as best as possible. But I think we're going to have to look to our public health leaders to help tell us when that point is, because they're the ones with all the data on how widespread this is. But it will come to a point where it will be the predominant infection in the community, but we really need the leaders in public health to help us with that.
So let me first, Doctor, thank you for your service. You're on the front lines, as well as our other healthcare providers, the doctors, the nurses, the people that work in hospitals, the people that work in these testing labs. We want to thank all of you for your service. We realize you're under a lot of pressure right now, and we need people to work together with you. Again, I want to emphasize prevention, prevention, prevention. If you think there's any possibility, and everybody should be thinking there's a possibility, everyone should be thinking, I have to try and keep myself away from other people, and I need to keep away from other people. So that doesn't mean, you know, you can't still talk to people on the phone. You can still do social media. You can still actually go outside and go for a walk or go to a park. But don't go within 6 feet of other people. Everybody's got to be treating themselves that way. That's why this is so different than we've had before. And that's not to cause people to panic. That's to cause people to say, if everybody does their little piece of doing the social distancing, of doing this physical distancing, I should say, then we'll be in much better shape a week from now and 2 weeks from now. This will probably will get worse as time goes on.
Congressman Swazi, I just wanted to add something to that. I think we're unique in our area in that Michael Dowling, as the leader of our health system, is very well connected to New York State government, and it helps link those, it helps fill the gap of public health and healthcare systems by having individuals getting this information out to our primary care physicians. So I think we'll be learning more about that question that the doctor just asked.
And let me just bring up something else, Maria, that I forgot to mention earlier. A few days ago in Nassau County, I was speaking to the Nassau County Health Commissioner earlier today, they were having 10 or 20 new diagnoses a day, but that's because the testing was so little. Yesterday, they had 140 new cases. So it's actually doubled in Nassau County over just the past day and a half. It's up to now 367 cases. So, okay, let's open it up for another question. Cindy?
The next question is from Hal Lyman.
Hi, this is Hal. Yes, hi, this is Hal Lyman. I'm a registered nurse. I live in Great Neck. And I actually have two questions. the first one is I'm wondering how much research has been done with regard to the immunological status of people who have been infected, been sick, and recovered, because if healthcare workers in that population could be identified, if they have antibodies, they could be very vital to the fight. That's my first question. And then the second question is, has there been any discussion or planning for cohorting, communal cohorting in large communal spaces of subacute cases as it gets higher? Because, I've read that in China, it's the second week where people go very quickly. They decompensate into ARDS, and when you have subacute cases that are being monitored, you can respond to that fast.
I'm sorry. What was your first name again?
Hal, H-A-L.
Hal, thanks very much, and we appreciate the work you're doing as a nurse, but you're using very technical language that not a lot of people will understand. So you're saying that if you get sick and you recover, will you be immune from getting sick again, and therefore you could be more helpful in helping to address this problem going forward. As a matter of fact, a woman called me the other day. She's just been diagnosed. She's recovering. She wants to know, as soon as she recovers, she wants to go volunteer. She wants to know if she'll be immune and she can go do that.
Yep.
Your second part of your question about cohorting, I didn't really understand. So let's Maria answer both of those questions about
people and immune. I think Michael Dowling can help us with the second one. But I'll start with the first one in terms of, for example, right now, staff that have been exposed, develop COVID positive status, and recover, become asymptomatic, they can go back and work on COVID units. They are protected. The studies so far, or the evidence out there from China over the last 3 months, South Korea and Italy, what we're learning is that employees, healthcare workers, are safe to go back to work once they've had COVID positive, and they're assigned to work in COVID positive units. Their CDC is looking at the development of an antibody test. It's not ready yet, but that would be hopeful in the next few months. I think it were months as opposed to weeks for that test to be ready. I hope it's sooner, but whereby you could get a test done to see if you're immune, just like we do now for chickenpox or measles to see that you have immunity to those illnesses. So that would be very helpful in the future to do that.
So right now we think that you will be immune. It's not proven yet, but we think that you're immune after you recover.
Yes. Yes.
So what about the second question about the cohorts? You have to interpret that. I didn't know what you were saying.
Okay. So he was asking about if you have an illness and it's not severe, it's mild, because he described the case of you can be mildly ill but easily change. The illness can change rapidly where you can worsen and develop ARDS, is acute respiratory distress syndrome. And it's an inflammatory response in your lungs, and that's the group that gets on ventilators. So the idea is to cohort people, still monitor them, but not necessarily in a hospital setting. Can we do that? And, in fact, there are plans to do that, and Michael Dowling has kind of been heavily involved in this planning phase.
Yeah, all of this requires us to change our policies and our procedures as we learn more. And so, yes, there have been discussions about the possibility of doing something like that. Nothing definitive yet, but where the discussions are ongoing, the question is where, how, et cetera. So, and as we learn more, that we'll be doing other things that we today can't even imagine, because we're not sure what the results would be. But the answer to the question is, yes, we're looking at it.
Okay, I want to emphasize, again, something that Mike and Maria talked about earlier. Most people recover. Most people are mild. Right now, in all of New York State, there are 777 people that are hospitalized. So that number is going to grow. More people are going to be diagnosed. It's going to spread. That's why prevention, social distancing, physical distancing is so important. Not saying that to scare you, saying that so you'll be prepared and you'll be responsible. Okay, let's open it up for another question.
Next question is from Sharon Kay.
Sharon? You there, Sharon?
How do I get on here?
Yeah.
You're there, Sharon. You're on the call now. Yeah, where are you from, Sharon?
Hello?
Sharon, where are you from?
Dix Hills.
Okay. So what's your question?
Yes, I have a question. My brother is up in Rockland County. He's in his late 70s, and he has a serious case of polycythemia vera for quite a few years. So his immunities are very poor. He lives currently with my niece, who is an oncology nurse, in a hospital in your system and runs a program. It's in a separate building, but they had a case where they were concerned that one of their patients had the coronavirus. It did come back eventually negative. However, she's exposed on a daily basis. When she returns home, She goes through a routine of completely stripping down in the garage, going upstairs, putting this in the laundry, then she goes in the shower. But I'm still concerned that her exposure could put my brother in harm's way. We live in Huntington, Long Island, in a very large home where there's plenty of distance between people. We have en suites all over the house. My concern is, would he not be better off here and safer here, where we have no children, no exposure, no one's coming in, no one's really going out, and I've taken all sorts of precautions to make this house safe.
Okay, let's let Maria answer that question. Maria?
So I think that's a very creative solution or option for him, and he should seriously consider it. It sounds like you would provide support, you would provide space, and it may relieve some fears of your niece, perhaps. So I think it's a reasonable option that he should seriously consider. But, you know, there's a lot of personal choices people have to make around this
decision,
illness.
Right. It's a family decision. It's a family decision, but your instinct of trying to provide him with more space where he's around less people and less risk behavior is probably a right instinct on your part. Okay, let's have another question.
Next is Linda Law.
Yeah, hi, this is Linda. I'm calling from Port Washington.
Okay,
so I have two concerns. One is when people are tested positive and they're quarantined, I mean, are they not going to the supermarket? Are they not, like, out there? My second question is it okay to go out and take a walk?
If they're tested positive, they should definitely not be going out to the supermarket. They should not be going around any other people whatsoever. They've got to stay home. They've got to stay quarantined. They should not be interacting with other people in any way whatsoever. And, in fact, each day the health department is given a list, and yesterday they were a little bit backlogged because they went from 10 or 20 cases in Nassau to 140 in one day. It's the same in New York City and the same in Suffolk. They're a little overwhelmed, but the health department gets a list every day, and they actually do spot checks on people to make sure that they're actually quarantining themselves at home, to make sure that they are not going out once they are diagnosed. That's very, very important that people, once they're diagnosed, are quarantined. That means not going outside. And family members that are close to them have to take special care for them to be isolated as well and stay away from other people, people that have any interaction with them. And as far as you going for a walk outside, you can certainly go for a walk outside. But Michael and Dr. Carney?
Yeah, this is where individual responsibility is so important. And also somebody like that has, you know, they have to understand that if they don't comply and stay at home, they're putting other people in danger. So it is very, very important that, as Tom mentioned, that they do not go around and be with other people if they're positive.
That is correct. Yeah. When someone's discharged from the hospital with a COVID positive status, we have to check that they have their own space, their own bedroom and bathroom, protecting the other household members from any spread. So, yes, they have to self-isolate with their own bedroom, their own bathroom, and they are quarantined and really have to minimize the spread of this. This can be, while rare, a serious illness. We want to minimize the spread at all costs. They have to self-isolate.
Okay. Let's open it up for another question.
Next question is from John Bowery.
Okay, John.
Who was that?
John.
Me?
Yes.
Hello?
John. Yeah, where are you?
Okay, John? Then. I'm in Huntington Station. I have two questions. How long can the virus live on different surfaces? Now, I'm asking this for outside my home. In other words, like grocery shopping, and the guy happens to sneeze, and how long will that last on the surface if he has it?
Maria, can you answer that one?
Sure.
I read this the other day, but I forget the details.
Yeah, sure. This virus is spread by contact. Really not as much. It used to be thought it was spread by respiratory droplets, but that's not so much the fear anymore. It's more by contact. touching the virus, touching your eye, touching your mouth, your face. And there are different reports. And again, this is a new virus. We only have 3 months worth of data. And I'm hearing that it can stay on the surfaces up to 10 minutes. But then there are some laboratory studies that suggest it can be longer than that, maybe even into hours. But the laboratory studies, we don't know how practical they are. And so basically it's minutes to hours, I would say, would be the range. And why wiping down, cleaning with bleach-like products or
washing
your hands is so important here.
So John, I've read some things that they could live even longer on plastic and metal surfaces for longer than 10 minutes, I read somewhere, but I can't confirm that. I'm not a scientist. I'm not a doctor. Nobody really knows the exact answer to these things right now. That's why it's important you stay 6 feet apart from each other. When you come to touch things, when you touch a doorknob of a building you're walking into, when you're going to the supermarket and you're pushing a cart, you need to bring a wipe with you to try and clean it off first. That's why they close the gyms down, for example.
And the main thing is that don't touch your mouth, your nose, or your eyes.
Yep.
If you touch something and you're suspicious or you just worry about it, try not to touch your face.
And then wash your hands as soon as you can.
And wash your hands as soon as you can.
Okay, there's 19,000 people on the call right now. Okay, let's open it up to the next question.
Next question is from Dr. Holly Shaw.
Dr. Holly?
Hi, I'm a nursing professor at Long Island University, and I spent many years at Long Island Jewish in the North Shore system, and we're so grateful to Michael Dowling and all of our contacts. But as a dedicated and proud nurse, I'd like to hear about how you're establishing the nursing workforce and how nurses who are retired or professors can help our colleagues in the hospital on the front line.
We've been reaching out. I'm delighted you asked that question. We have been reaching out to all nurses that have retired and doctors that have retired and asking whether or not, and I hope that if you've not been contacted, hopefully you will, asking how many would like to actually help and volunteer. Not necessarily working with COVID patients, but obviously substituting in other areas where we would need help, so because we have to deploy staff in different locations. So if you're interested in volunteering, please let us know. The same with anybody else that is a professional on this call that would be interested. We're making a list, and when needed, we would like to have the opportunity to call you.
Okay, when you get off the call, Dr. Holly, let's make sure that you give your name and phone number, and we'll try and get it to the right people at the Northwell system. And I'm sure there's going to be right now, you know, we're kind of in this mode of prevention and getting the testing and getting the systems put in place. There's going to be a massive volunteer effort that's going to be needed at some point. So people that are willing to volunteer, that have some skills in this area, I'm sure the hospitals and the government will actually be working on trying to recruit you, but we're not up to that phase just yet.
Yeah.
Okay, let's open it up to the next question.
Next question is Brett Reeves.
Brett? You there, Brett?
Hi. Yes. Hi, Brett Reeves, concerned citizen, Port Washington. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, Brett.
Great. Two questions. Director Hahn today at the press conference mentioned something about convalescent plasma. I'm wondering, is that a potential solution to the problem? And the second question, and it's a tough one, you know, if things do get out of control and there's 20 people showing up at the hospital with the need for 20 respirators, and there's only 10 respirators, what are the protocols that a Northwell hospital will follow in allocating those scarce resources?
So I'll take those questions. The first question about convalescent plasma, I am not aware of that as a therapy for this. at this time. I will say that there are studies that Northwell's involved in and other centers, NIH as well, utilizing antivirals and anti-inflammatants specifically to try to decrease the cytokine inflammation that creates this inflammatory response in the lungs. And so it's exciting that there are treatment options currently being treated. But unfortunately, I'm not aware of the convalescent plasma that you're talking about.
And the president mentioned today chloroquine and hydrochloroquine are two things that people are exploring. And I heard about a drug that Gilead is looking at that's going through clinical trials as we speak.
We're involved in some of those trials with the Gilead drug and the drug with Regeneron see whether or not these drugs could be used.
Say the name of that drug,
Remdesivir.
That's one going through the clinical trials. Chloroquine and hydrochloroquine are drugs that have been around for a long, long time. They know that they're not going to hurt you.
Used with rheumatoid arthritis, again, with the same concept of being anti-inflammatory. And they're being used on patients now.
So let's all pray, if we could find a solution or treatment, I should say, that we're all comfortable with, that would be a big step in helping to reduce a lot of this anxiety that exists.
Involved in some of those studies at the moment.
Okay, let's hope. He had a second question. What was the second
question? He had a second question, a really difficult issue, but we are we are making plans if we face the situation. While we are seeking out respirators, Michael Dowling spoke about that, the supply issue, we are making protocols to help our physicians. You have to understand, the physicians and nurses are very at the front lines concerned about this situation, and we have got to create thoughtful, compassionate, evidence-based protocols to help our doctors in this situation should there be a limited resource. And these are unprecedented times. It is frightening for the frontline doctors and nurses to be in this potential situation. So we are in the process of trying to think, how can we do this thoughtfully with our colleagues across different health systems and possibly with the state? But it has to be done with evidence-based advocacy and support for people who are going to have to make some of these decisions, perhaps.
And doctor, that's
the state health commissioner is very involved with us on this right now and every other health system to try to make these decisions.
And those are very challenging things that the health professionals have to think about, but I'm going to get patriotic for a second. The United States of America can figure this out. We did it during World War II, where we ramped up with equipment over a short period of time. That's why the governor is asking for the Army Corps of Engineers to come in and help to retrofit hospitals right now to try and bring the might of the private sector and the public sector together to attack this problem as though we're on a war footing. We should be thinking about, how do we get our friends in the private sector to go manufacture these ventilators right now as we speak? We're not in this crisis stage yet. To avoid getting there, one of the things we need to do is we need to use the Defense Production Act, if necessary, and get the private sector to manufacture these ventilators that we need. Right now, we don't have enough. We need more. We need to get the ones that are in the stockpile. There's the most ventilators in America are right now in the national stockpile. We need to have those released, some of them released, here in New York State, which is one of the epicenters of this problem, or is the epicenter of the problem in the country. And we need to get the private sector working together with the government to manufacture these ventilators as quickly as possible. Okay, let's open it up to the next question.
The next question is from Ms. Tony Gioa of Plainview.
Tony?
Hi, good evening. Hi, good evening. Hi. This is Tony.
Hi.
How are you? Here's my question. All right, first of all, I want to thank all the medical personnel who put themselves at risk to help those with the coronavirus daily. It's amazing, and it's worth noting. But my question is, currently the at-will social distancing is only fully effective if everyone does it. And as we know, not everybody is fully complying. So due to that fact and the fact that we are also in need of medical supplies and things that may not come through for quite some time, do you think we'll get to a point of a full shutdown or sheltering in place either at the county or national level? Or are we as aggressive as we're going to get with social contact?
So let me answer that question. I'm a big advocate for shutting things down for a couple weeks. Other people are advocating for that as well. I think the governor has made a lot of bold moves in this perspective. He reduced people working to 50% of the workforce a couple days ago. He would cut it down to 75% reduction today, so only 25% of the people should be going to work. The governor's been concerned about the term shelter in place because that's actually a term that was coined when people were in a shooting, and they should shelter in place before the shooter leaves. So we don't want to create that kind of fearful environment like that. But I think that we're going to move more and more towards people getting the message that they have to stay at home, that they can't work. That's going to impact all the economic questions that I talked about in the beginning of the phone call. It's going to affect individuals who are not working, people that are laid off. It's going to increase unemployment. We have to have more unemployment insurance. We have to have more food stamps. We have to have child care for people. We have to get more money to our governments. We have to help small businesses with low or no interest loans. We have to give people a debt holiday from paying their mortgage, from paying their rents, from paying their credit card. And then the people that are not getting paid, we have to help them. And we have to help some of the crucial industries in America as well as part of the process. But first, we need to take care of the people that go to work every day that are no longer working and are trying to survive paycheck to paycheck. And then we need to think long-term about a massive infrastructure plan in America to put people back to work and give this economy a jump start again. So right now, 75% reduction of the workforce in New York State, unless you're in an essential industry. For example, the hospital on here, they have to continue working. Supermarkets need to keep working. Pharmacies need to keep working. So, but otherwise, people should be telecommuting, working from home, working as much as they can from home. Some businesses, you know, they're not bringing any income in. That's why this is such an economic problem, and I want people to feel comfortable because we haven't had a chance to talk about it here tonight, and our call is almost out of time. People are working at the federal level and the state level, especially at the federal level, for a massive package of $1 trillion. The president is talking about $1 trillion. The Democrats are talking about $1 trillion. The Senate's talking about $1 trillion to make a massive investment to protect people that are being economically smashed by this issue right now. And you'll be hearing more about that over the next week as to what's happening. There's already been several bills that have been passed that have tried to address some of these issues, to invest in developing a vaccine, to invest in small business loans, to invest in unemployment insurance, to give people paid family leave. You know, America is one of the only countries in the world that does not provide mandatory paid sick leave to people. So that's something that was done for the purpose of this crisis right now, but we're going to need to do more of it for the long term as well. We need to protect our healthcare workers that they can go to work. If their kids are off from school, there has to be child care assistance for them so they can keep on going to work and not worry about their kids at home that are not going to school right now. So there's a lot of work that's being done. We're going to just keep on working together and we'll get through this thing. I think we can take one more question.
Next question is from Rebecca Eichel.
Rebecca?
Yes, yes. This is Rebecca Cohen from Great Neck. I was wondering what are the chances of survival for pregnant women if they catch this and the infant, the newborn that is in their stomach, or once they give birth and the baby comes home, what are the chances for newborns up to 6 years old catching this disease? That's okay. Number one question or number two questions. And number three, for what are the chances of survival for people who do have immune system problems, diseases, that they are on medications that actually lower their immune systems?
Okay, so the first question is about pregnant women. So interesting, pregnant women are not really a risk group for this illness, as thus far based on the 3 months of data that we have. And in our health system, we have had
some pregnant women who have become COVID positive and delivered, and they're doing well. So it's possible. And for whatever reasons, we don't fully understand why, pregnant women are not necessarily a risk group here. So that's the good news. The second question about the survival for immune on medications that suppress the immune system. So we have more survival data from the past 3 months based on age, and it increases, or mortality increases with age. However, we don't know necessarily if it's just age or with age. You tend to have more chronic illnesses. You may have more medical problems that you accumulate with age. So we don't fully understand what are the mortality risks. Having just medications for diabetes or taking medications for blood pressure or something else doesn't, we're not sure that that's a contributor to mortality. We don't know enough about what's causing the mortality and why it increases with age. There may be, as we age, there's just, okay, I can keep talking, Tom, so you can tell me to
okay,
be quiet.
Okay, well, I think we have to wrap it up. Let me just say, Mike and Maria, both, thank you so much. Why don't you both give a 30-second closing statement? Let me say to all the people on the call, we've had 19,700 people on this call. I'm so grateful to our guest speakers. If anyone wants to leave feedback at the end of the call, you can press 1, and you can leave feedback at the end of the call. If you want to call my office, you can call 631-923-4100, 631-923-4100. My office is telecommuting also. Just some of the people are there, so please be patient with them, 631-923-4100. So I'm going to ask each of you to give a 30-second closing statement, and then I'll wrap it up.
So let me just, again, thank you all for being on the phone. It shows, obviously, the interest here. And what I would say just very briefly is we're going to have a rough time for the next couple of months. Who knows how long, but a month or two. But this will be over with at some point. We will win this. And it's important to keep that in mind. We have for a period of time now lots of inconvenience, social isolation, all the things we talked about. If everybody does what we should do, this will be beaten. We will beat this virus, and we will look back upon it as an experience that we learned an awful lot from and look forward. So this is not going to be with us forever. We will beat it.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you so much for your time. Especially, we know how involved you are in this process and spending the time with us. We're very grateful. Dr. Carney?
Yeah, I just want to say thank you both for letting me join you here tonight. I would like just emphasize what Michael Dowling just said, the social, the space, respecting those who may be at risk, trying to support, reach out to those who may be isolated at this time, help them out during this unprecedented time that we're in. And if you have concerns or illness, call your physician ahead of time, seek questions and answers through their office and support, and I'm honored to be here. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Carney. You did a fantastic job. Let me just close again by saying I want to emphasize, be prepared, not scared. That's why we want to share as much information as possible for people. Can't sugarcoat it. But be prepared, not scared. Most people recover from this. Some people are especially vulnerable if they're elderly or if they are compromised in some way previously. There are, however, a lot of young people that are getting diagnosed with coronavirus and are getting hospitalized. So young people need to be careful as much as elderly people do. There are 777 people hospitalized in New York State right now. That number is going to go up dramatically. We must, when thinking of healthcare, think of prevention, prevention, prevention. Have physical distance from other people. No more bars, no more parties, no more big groups of people. Wash your hands, wash your face. Don't touch your face. Don't go in big crowds. Testing, testing, testing. You're going to see a lot of numbers go up over the next few days because there's going to be more testing, which means there'll be more diagnoses and it'll sound scarier. But we expect that to happen. That's not going to be a shock to people. Treatment, we got to work on these ventilators. We got to work on these gloves and masks and gowns. We have to work on getting the hospital beds. We have to help protect and thank our healthcare workers who are on the front lines here, and we need to keep on working on figuring out what the best way to address this is. And for the economic side, all the people feeling the anxiety about the economic issues, people are working to try and figure out how to alleviate the suffering as much as possible and keep the economy afloat, because once this is over, we're going to come roaring back. We need to work on paid family leave, unemployment insurance, food stamps, child care coverage. We need to get money to our local governments. We need to support our small businesses with huge low interest and no interest loans. We need to give people a holiday on their mortgages and credit cards and their rents and their leases. We need to work together to try and support some of our big industries. And when it's all said and done, we need to do a massive stimulus project for infrastructure in the United States of America. There'll be a lot of debate about that, but I think that's one of the most important things. I think working together on the medical issues, the healthcare issues, and the economic issues, getting the healthcare industry, government, and the private sector, and the not-for-profit sector all working together, we can whip this thing. Thank you so much for joining the call tonight. We really appreciate everybody's time. Thank you.
Thank you.